It's Wednesday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry calls on China to urge North Korea to limit its nuclear program.
Kim Jong-un's actions are reckless and they are dangerous.
A New World Corruption report says Somalia, North Korea, and Afghanistan are the most corrupt nations. And a movie about a 19th century escaped slave called Nat Turner wins rave reviews at a Utah film festival. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Wednesday held several hours of talks in Beijing with his Chinese counterpart, Foreign Minister Wang Yi. Both diplomats say they support a new U.N. Security Council resolution on North Korea's nuclear program. But Mr. Kerry called for a significant new measures to punish Pyongyang for its fourth nuclear blast on January 6. Mr. Wang cautioned a new resolution must not provoke new tensions or destabilize the Korean Peninsula. Mr. Kerry spoke at a joint news conference.
Kim Jong-un's actions are reckless and they are dangerous. Whether or not he achieved the explosion of a hydrogen weapon is not what makes the difference. It's that he is trying, that he wants to do that, and made the attempt against all of the international sanctions and resolutions that have been passed by the global community to prohibit that behavior. This test was a blatant violation of the UN Security Council resolution. And as permanent members of the Security Council, our two countries and other countries are obligated to take action. But one of the things that we emphasize today is that there has been a lot of talk about North Korea through these past years. Now is the time, we believe, for action that can bring North Korea back to the table. I agree with my fellow minister. There is a goal in sanctions. It's to get to the negotiations. And we must make it clear that is our objective, to negotiate the end to the nuclear program.
Mr. Kerry noted that global sanctions help bring Iran to the nuclear negotiating table. Mr. Wang pressed to do more to pressure its ally to give up its nuclear program, insists Beijing's position opposing it and seeking a diplomatic resolution has been clear-cut and responsible. The editor of the Asia-Pacific current events publication, The Diplomat, Ankit Panda, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he does not expect the talks will provide a high degree of success.
Overall, there is simply no common understanding between the United States and China on the right way to approach the North Korean issue, and nothing really changed with the nuclear test in that regard. The United States continues to insist that North Korea has to make some sort of bona fide gesture of denuclearization before it will consider returning to negotiations, and China continues to push for restraint and a return to the six-party talks process, which has been dead for about half a decade now. So it's really not a positive prognosis at this point.
Well, North Korea walked out of those talks, as I recall.
Absolutely, they did. Those fell apart, and they haven't come back together since. And Kim Jong-un obviously took over in 2011, and we've seen two nuclear tests under him with no sign of the North Korean nuclear program slowing down.
When news media write headlines like Kerry to urge China to put more pressure on North Korea, what does it mean? What could China do that it's not doing now?
Stopping oil exports, stopping civilian flights flying over its territory. But in general, the United States would be interested in seeing China apply strong UN sanctions against North Korea, which it is not willing to do, because Beijing holds the position that this problem is something that needs to be solved through diplomacy, through restraint, and it doesn't believe that punishing North Korea is the right path. And, you know, there is a degree of self-interest there for China. Refugees regularly cross the border into China from North Korea with great difficulty. And China worries that if the hammer of sanctions comes down even further, internal instability in North Korea could destabilize its border with the country. And that's obviously very negative for Beijing. So Beijing is happy to maintain a modicum of stability. Obviously, it's not happy with the nuclear test at all. China definitely does not support North Korea's continued nuclear developments, but it's also not keen to see economic difficulties in North Korea destabilize the country, potentially leading to a collapse of the regime or a potential refugee influx into China.
So if there's no progress made in forging some sort of common front between China and the United States vis-a-vis North Korea, where does the answer to responding to North Korea's latest nuclear test come from? Would it be the UN?
No, and that's actually the question that many policymakers and experts are wrangling with right now. There's really no consensus. And my sense, you know, talking to experts after North Korea's nuclear test, including experts with 20, 25 years of experience dealing with North Korea and the United States, is that essentially, we're at an impasse. There is the uncomfortable prospect that some people propose of acknowledging North Korea as a nuclear state and using that as the starting step to negotiations with North Korea, and essentially acknowledging that the policy conversation needs to shift from preventing North Korea from becoming a nuclear state to containing it as a nuclear state. And obviously, as you can imagine, that's politically very uncomfortable.
That's Ankit Panda of the Asia-Pacific Current Events publication, The Diplomat. The state-run Xinhua News Agency, in a commentary, said it was unrealistic to rely merely on China to press North Korea to abandon its nuclear program as long as the U.S. continues an antagonistic approach wrought by a Cold War mentality. Meanwhile, here in Washington, Republican Senator Susan Collins, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, tells VOA her concerns about North Korea's nuclear program.
The presence of any nuclear weapons and the continuing testing of them in North Korea is a major concern. North Korea is already isolated from the entire world. There aren't additional sanctions that can be imposed. I would like to see China, which is North Korea's major benefactor, without which North Korea could not feed its people at all. It doesn't feed them very well as it is, but it could not feed them at all without Chinese help. Step up to the plate and tell the North Koreans that they need to halt their nuclear program.
That's Senator Susan Collins of Maine. Well, joining us with a look at what's being said on the internet about the U.S.-China talks is my colleague, Susan Yockey.
Hi, Sarah, everyone. Sarah, as you've been mentioning, Reuters reports in an article by David Brunstrom and Megha Rajagopalan that in a sign that Beijing could be reluctant to take a more hardline stance on North Korea, state news agency Xinhua said it was unrealistic to rely merely on China to depress the DPRK to abandon its nuclear program. But CNN Politics reports U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said all nations, particularly those who seek a global leadership role or have a global leadership role, have a responsibility to deal with this threat.
Well, Susan, what else is online today?
Well, a story I know you're going to have more on a little later. The World Corruption Report, which can be reached at their site, www.transparency.org. VOANews.com reports a new report lists Somalia, North Korea, and Afghanistan as the most highly corrupt nations on Earth. D.W. Rutschhoff says, rays of hope, corruption perception index, more countries improved than declined. Make Trap tweets, an anti-graft watchdog group, says public sector corruption is still a major problem around the world. Mangai S. Karuki tweets, deep trouble when debate is about who's more or less corrupt. Abdullah Yadgar notes two worldwide reports out today, Corruption Perception Index and a Human Rights Watch report, and both failed to improve. And Sarah, today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day and was trending according to Twitter. Natalie Bennett tweets, Holocaust Memorial Day, a time to remember millions murdered, but also many saved by compassion and courage. Philip Rosenberg says, this Holocaust Memorial Day, let's recommit to preventing genocide. Discover Medical London tweets on Holocaust Memorial Day, sobering to remember that all professionals were complicit. And it has a picture with doctors' trial for war crimes in 1946. Nahal Arthanikwai writes, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism is hate. Don't complain about one if you tolerate the other. Sarah?
Thanks, Susan. That's International Edition Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute. A team of experts at North Carolina's Duke University are tweaking a simple new blood test they've developed that will allow medical professionals to determine whether a respiratory illness stems from a viral or bacterial infection. Bacterial infections are usually treated with antibiotics, which are ineffective against viral infections. The test will help doctors pinpoint the appropriate antibiotics to fight the infection if it's bacterial in nature and consider treatments other than antibiotics if caused by a virus. The scientists who are developing this blood test say they hope that it will help stem the trend of overprescribing antibiotics, which some say has led to an increase of antimicrobial resistant bacterial strains. One of the lead researchers, Dr. Ephraim Salik, said that about three-fourths of respiratory patients are prescribed antibiotics, despite the fact that the majority actually have viral infections. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at ties between China and Vietnam. The Berlin-based anti-corruption group Transparency International Wednesday released its annual Global Perceptions Index of official graft. The report showed that while most countries are perceived as highly corrupt, many improved their scores in 2015. Finn Heinrich, the group's research director, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, average citizens are taking action and speaking out against corruption, and in some cases, governments are responding.
A country like Senegal, which, you know, some years ago was not seen as a positive story on corruption, really has getting the basics right. So I think what you need is an engaged citizenry which demands accountability and change, and leaders which hear the call and take action.
Well, aren't many of these countries authoritarian and they don't really listen to the will of the people?
Yes. I mean, if you look at the bottom of the index, you have basically two cases, right? You have one, countries which have governments which have lost control over their territory, which don't provide the basic services, failed states, basically, right? Libya, Yemen, and others. Or you have very authoritarian countries, as you say, who have, I would argue, too much control over their society, who don't allow citizens to hold them accountable, who don't care about citizens and their needs. And both those cases are very fertile soil for corruption.
Well, you mentioned specifically Guatemala, Sri Lanka, and Ghana, where citizen activists in groups and on their own work to drive out corruption.
That's right. I mean, Guatemala is an interesting example because there really millions of people have demanded change at the highest echelons of power over the last year, and they have succeeded, supported by the international community, who set up an international court to prosecute corruption, and the president is now being prosecuted. And that was something which I think was unfathomable 2-3 years ago. So it takes both, you know, demand from the bottom and then support either from the top or international actors.
Well, Finn, Transparency says Brazil was the biggest decliner in the index.
That's correct. Brazil is the biggest decliner. It has gone down by 5 points, which is indicates really corruption is getting worse. Major scandals are erupting corruption, as the prosecutor of the country himself acknowledges, is rife everywhere. And the government is not really doing enough to show that they are serious about cleaning up the act, particularly at the highest levels in ministries and the president being implicated herself.
Well, this year, Transparency has called on people to take action by voting at a website. What's going on there?
Yeah, we listed 10 cases of what we call grand corruption, where really powerful people have diverted money, public money, to their own private interest. And people can come to the site unmaskthecorrupt.org and vote for the case which they think symbolizes the scourge of corruption most prominently.
That's Finn Heinrich of Transparency International. That website is unmaskthecorrupt.org. Transparency's Index of Expert Opinions ranked the perceptions of public sector corruption in 168 countries. Denmark took the top place again for the second year in a row, while North Korea and Somalia were found to be the worst performers. China watchers are closely observing this week's political leadership transition in Vietnam and its implications for future Sino-Vietnamese ties. Shannon Van Sant reports from Hong Kong.
Vietnam's 12th National Congress is meeting this week, during which it will choose its leaders for the next 5 years. Prime Minister Nguyen Thanh Dong has effectively withdrawn from the contest to become the Communist Party General Secretary after being excluded from an official list of candidates for positions in the Central Committee. His pro-Beijing rival, Nguyen Phu Chang, will remain General Secretary, the top position in Vietnam's leadership. Some analysts say this year's election process revealed the importance of Sino-Vietnam relations. Xiao Ha Chung is a professor of international relations at China's Renmin University.
I think that the so-called pro-Beijing leaders, Mr. Trump, will come to rule that country. So I think that would be a good sign from Chinese perspective.
Other analysts say the election reveals China's strong hand in the region and its pressure on its neighbor, Vietnam. Members of Vietnam's General Assembly visited Beijing in December, where some suspect China voiced its concerns about the government's ties with the U.S. Dong was perceived as a supporter of closer ties with the U.S., while rival Chang has pushed for improved relations with Beijing. The leadership transition comes at a sensitive time for Sino-Vietnamese relations. Last week, Vietnam said China had placed an oil rig in disputed waters off the South China Sea, a move which may have been intended as a warning to Vietnam during the National Congress meetings. A Chinese rig in waters claimed by Vietnam sparked mass protest in 2014. This year, protesters have been mostly silent. And days before the meeting of Vietnam's National Congress, the country's military staged a mass exercise in the country's capital. Carl Thayer, professor emeritus at Australia's National Defense Academy, says suppression of voices critical of China is likely to increase after the leadership transition.
So it is to be as inoffensive as possible towards China, to wear China's encroachments on Vietnamese sovereignty and protests, and in the hopes that somehow the socialism and the bonds of Marxist-Leninism that will unite the two countries will mean that Vietnam will be out of the heat.
Vietnam is one of the last remaining communist countries in the world, and its ties to China waver between closer relations sought for ideological and economic reasons and fear of China's potential encroachment of Vietnam's political and territorial sovereignty. Wang Dong is a professor of international relations at Peking University.
I think it's also clear that the current consensus that China-Vietnamese relations have to be improved, I think this consensus will be maintained. And now this is very important. And also, I think Chinese leaders and the Vietnamese leaders share the view that, while despite the fact that there are some differences between the two countries regarding the territory issue, but they also both agree that they share much more common interests.
But while this week's political transition in Vietnam may improve relations with China, territorial disputes continue to ratchet up tensions across Asia. Vietnam recently announced it will allow India to set up a satellite tracking center in southern Vietnam that will provide it with access to overhead images of the South China Sea. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
This is VOA.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition, a new film that tells the story of Nat Turner, a slave who taught himself to read and then lead a slave rebellion in 1831, has created a buzz at this year's Sundance Film Festival in Utah. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, The Birth of a Nation has people talking Oscars before it's even released to theaters.
Nate Parker took 7 years to write the screenplay for The Birth of a Nation. The film, in which Parker also stars and directs, tells the story of Nat Turner, a slave boy who learns to read and becomes a preacher in pre-Civil War Virginia. His masters hope that Turner's preaching will lead other slaves to be more subservient, so Nat is sent to other plantations to preach to the slaves. but his knowledge of the Bible and his exposure to the true misery of slavery soon lead Turner to encourage his fellow slaves to rebel against their masters. Nat Turner's rebellion left 60 slave owners and hundreds of slaves dead. Parker says that the film looks at the origins of issues that African Americans still have to deal with.
You know, my job as a filmmaker is to create content, to seek out material, to develop material that I think will help be progressive and deal with some of the systemic issues that we're dealing with. So to be able to write a project and then to go out and get it financed and attach talent and to go and shoot the movie and then to have Sundance recognize it and validate it and say this is something that we think is worth showing to the world and getting behind and sponsoring. I think that those are the steps that we need to take.
Armie Hammer, who plays Nat Turner's master Samuel, says that even though this is Parker's directorial debut, he ran the set like a seasoned veteran.
He showed up on the first day, and he wasn't shooting that day, but he showed up and he was in a suit, he had the tie on, and he walks and he's like, put that camera over there, put this lens on it, bring me a viewfinder with this lens, move that light 6 feet this way, and you two stand on your mark and get over there, and bring me those two things, blah, blah, blah. And he walked on the set with the confidence and skill and ability of someone who's directed 50 movies before.
The film comes at a time when Hollywood is wrestling with a lack of diversity in its Oscar nominations. Nate Parker says that the Oscar issue is just a symptom of a much wider problem.
I feel the injury every day that's happening in America, whether it be socially, you know, Eric Garner, Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin. I mean, there's just so many names. And I felt at some point, I have to live a legacy that addresses that for my children. So when my kids say, man, in 2016, there were a lot of things happening, Dad, like, what were you doing? I can say, you know what, I was addressing it with my talent, you know, with my tool, using my ammo, which is film, to address issues that I felt needed attention.
Armie Hammer says that Parker's passion for the project carried the cast and crew through some very difficult times.
You could feel his passion bleeding out of him while we were doing this. You know, everybody else would be getting tired, everybody else would be uncomfortable with the subject matter, which at some points in the film gets heavier, you know, but he would be there unwavering, just the perfect leader for the project, really.
The film received several standing ovations at its premiere in Park City, Utah. Fox Searchlight Pictures has paid a record $17.5 million for the distribution rights. That's $7 million more than the previous Sundance record for Little Miss Sunshine. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.